welcome to another edition of Shoot Your Takedown with myself, Gustav Rossi, alongside John Hobbs. On this episode, we had the pleasure of interviewing former WEC and UFC fighter Brad One Punch Pickett.
Just to kick things off, I know you were recently on Fight Island in Abu Dhabi. Talk to us a little bit about the experience and what the UFC have put together there.
What the UFC have done is just, it's like president to none. It's like phenomenal. They are the best organization in the world. So they can still put on great events like they have been doing over these sort of crazy times. And also doing it in the best way of doing it, you know, and the very... a high standard hotel that we go to, you all get looked after, loads of protocols of to do it. Like, I think I was tested 5 times in 10 days. It was crazy sort of protocols, kept everyone in a sort of bubble. And they left no stone unturned to get like an amazing event up and running. So obviously I was there in the first sort of Fight Island, or so Nathaniel for John Castaneda, and then we went back just recently. I was on the Fight Island Miguel again, so yeah, I enjoyed both my trips. They were very good.
Yeah, and the recent one was actually quite a close fight. Do you think he did enough to win the fight, and what does the future hold for him? That's Nathaniel Wood.
For me it was a razor close fight, you know. Yeah. Obviously I was very disappointed he didn't get the nod, but I was also very pleased with the fight in general. It was just a cracking fight, a lot of output. I was annoyed because like the judging for me was a little all over the place. I could understand there was one judge who gave him gave Casey the first round and the third round, but gave Nathaniel the second one. And for me, even though I thought Nathaniel did enough in the first round as well, I kind of like, if I agreed with anyone, I'd be like, hey, I can see that guy.
Yeah.
But the other two judges, one judge gave Casey the first and the second round, and Nathaniel the third, which I found a bit strange. And then the other judge gave all 3 rounds to Casey. So that's what I just found it so, like, there was no consistency with the judges. And for me, I could not see how anyone could not score Nathaniel that second round. He outworked Casey. He outstruck him. Casey was looking tired. So that's why I just got really frustrated, because like the first round was close, could have gone either way. Second round, 100% for me and Nathaniel. And the third round was close again, but he gave a little bit of control to Casey when he went for the takedown and got Nathaniel's back a little bit. So you can see that. But I just don't know how in the life of me, I don't know how anyone could score Casey that second round. That's why I was kind of annoyed about the whole thing. But hey, he got fight night, got a good little win bonus. So you can't cry over spilled milk. You just got to move on with things, you know?
Yeah, I guess that's always been a bit of a problem, hasn't it? With not just MMA, I guess even boxing to a degree, is sometimes the judging, you just sit there scratching your head and it doesn't seem that there's been a solution. I know obviously Dana always talks about, when there's a big, wrong decision, let's say he feels a little bit like it's out of his hands. What do you think the solution is? I've heard some people talking about maybe getting ex-fighters judging. Do you think that would work? What do you reckon the best sort of solution is something like that?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, yeah, ex-judges would help a lot more because they have experience of fighting. But I mean, you say that, but then you get some, what I'd say, not the smartest fighters as well. You know, so it's just weird. It's just like what they need to do is let people know what the scoring criteria is, and I'll give more seminars, not just to judges, but to fighters, to see what the hell are these judges looking for, you know, sort of thing. So, yeah, it can be very frustrating, you know.
He turned in a great performance anyway, and I'm sure I'm not the only one that thought that was one of the best fights on the card, if not the best fight on the card. So it was definitely entertaining from a neutral point of view anyway.
Yeah.
And just moving on, are there any other big prospects coming out of your camp that we should keep a lookout for, or indeed any other British fighters on the local circuit that are going a little bit under the radar?
Well, yeah, at this moment, not a lot of people are really getting fights. I have a few what are called like studs on my team. I mean, I've got a lot of potential. I've got a few people fighting I'm just going to talk about my pros. I have a lot of good amateurs, but I'll talk about my pros. I've got a guy called Nick Bagley. He's a young Ukrainian English guy who's just, I mean, I think he's really got a bright future ahead of him. So he's fighting in a couple of weeks. He's only 1-0 as a pro, but he's like super talented. I have another young guy called Lonnie, who he's 3-0 as a pro. I'm finding it far hard for him to get fights. His name is Lonnie Kavanagh. I have a couple of guys fighting on Cage Warriors next on the Trilogy show in December. Wesley Meyer, he's Brazilian. But he's over here in the UK. He's based here. When it came to me, he was literally just a striker, but now he has great striking, great jiu-jitsu, and really good wrestling as well. And also he's so fun to watch. His name's Wesley Meyer. He's fine on next. And also Emery Simona's another. He's more experienced, I'd say.
Yeah.
He's 11-2 as a pro, but he's fine on that Cage Warriors card. And I have like some good guys, who, you know, some veterans like Ashley Grimshaw and Michael Kendall. I mean, I do have a really kind of good stable of guys, but especially in the smaller weight classes.
So a lot of names there to keep a lookout for.
And, yes, indeed.
Focusing a little bit on yourself now, I mean, you know, some of the fighters you fought over the years, it really is a who's who of fighters. And just rewinding a little bit back to some of your matchups, which ones, looking at that list, stand out for you and you look back at as, you know, great moments in your career?
Yes, I mean, there's a few kind of really good moments for me throughout my career that I really enjoyed. Obviously, winning the Cage Warriors belt and all that sort of stuff was awesome. But then obviously when I started going over to Bodog in Costa Rica, fighting there, fighting abroad was a great experience. But when I signed to like a big organization on the WEC back in those days, was a dream come true. It was so hard for a European fighter to get in the WEC back then because of visas. So when I fought made my WEC debut, it was in Vegas as well, which was a dream to fight in Vegas, especially when you get to any sort of level of fighting, you want to fight in Vegas at some point. So it was to do my debut for the WC in Vegas and also to win by a really rare submission called a Peruvian necktie. That was one of the standout moments of my career. And just really, my favorite time in my career was in the WC. I had some great fights in that organization. Every fight I had was awesome.
Yeah.
Moving into the UFC, the knockout of Yves Jabron was a good moment for me. It was good to do that in front of my home crowd, sort of thing. But I mean, that's good moments. Obviously, a lot of people always ask me and quiz me about fighting Demetrius Johnson and getting winners of him. But for me, when I fought him, it was like a 14-0 pro. But you know, no one knew much about him. Obviously, he went on to do amazing things for the sport and for himself, but when I fought him, it was just a fight, so it didn't. If I beat him now, obviously it'd be a lot different, but when I beat him, it was just like, yeah, I'm gonna go in there and beat this kid, and I went in there and beat him.
You read my mind, actually, because that was the next question. Obviously, Mighty Mouse Demetrius Johnson, one of the greatest fighters of all time. Obviously, at the time you beat him, did you ever think that he'd reach the level he did? You know, to be such a dominant champion and have the career he's had. Did you ever think that, fighting him?
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, he showed a lot of promise and a lot. Going into that fight, he was highly talented, you know, like being a Matt Humes next prodigy and all that sort of stuff. So there was a lot of noise about him back then anyway. But for me, I was quite a established professional, I think, and I just beat him honestly quite comfortably. But since then, obviously, he went on and learned a lot from obviously getting beat changed things up, and gone and went, done great things, you know. But back, especially back then, I definitely knew he was very talented. He was really quick. I wouldn't say it was an easy fight at all. He was tough, but yeah, but I had to use my size and wrestle him.
Great. I'm just gonna jump in now. I mean, that's a great point. I mean, sometimes that's fun, to be honest, because it's back and forth. Well, I think you probably took him down more in one round. He's been taken down his whole career.
I'm not that I look at the copy stats, but I took him down 10 times in one fight in that fight. So I did take it down quite a bit.
Yeah, I mean, that was tremendous. And some of those takedowns, I mean, I think one of the things that I think, you know, like US fighters underestimate is some of the ground game that, you know, some of the top level Brits have. And I think you really showed the rest of there. Some of those takedowns were so dominant, picking him up and just throwing him down at will.
Yeah, I know. I remember a story because my coach is my training partner as well, and my coach out there was Mike Brown. I remember he was saying to me, he went back to the change room after that, and Uriah Faber and Chad Mendes was there. Yeah. And Chan, oh, that was a great performance. Well, then, where did he wrestle? and Mike says, no, he's never wrestled. He's from England.
yeah. Wrestled in the back garden as a kid. That was it.
That's the thing. I only picked up wrestling when I went to American Top Team and trained with Mike Brown, because I knew I did that early doors, because I knew that's a massive part of the sport that I needed to get better at. And I just kind of like, it was like a duck to water. I really loved that sort of side of thing. And if I had wrestling as a kid in England, I definitely would have done something like that.
Yeah, I think, I mean, some of those some of those takedowns and some of those slams as well were, they're sort of, they're just very much sort of American style, you know, from sort of Matt Hughes type takedowns, you know. Where yeah, like, take someone to his corner and just like drop him. And I think at one point you injure your shoulder, don't you? Did you break it? Did you get a
no?
You fractured back?
It was the end of the second round. Yeah. Right at the end of the second round, I picked him up and I slammed him, maybe too hard to be honest. Like, and I'd be doing so, I separated my shoulder. I didn't feel it when I'd done it, because I'd done it and I heard him get. He was really winded when I'd done it. Yeah. And then I mounted him. I was trying to finish the fight. And then round finished, and I went back to my corner. Still didn't feel anything. Yeah. I thought, fine, chatting. I'm like, yeah, okay, I'm two rounds up. Cool. Right, carry on, whatever. And then I went start the third round. I went to throw a jab. And I was like, whoa, what's going on with my arm? And I thought I broke my collarbone or something. I was like, what's going on? And it just kind of like just was not working right. And then I could feel pain within the fight, which is strange. Because normally adrenaline takes over, but it was really painful in a fight. But then I would just react in certain things and stuff like that. But I remember at the end of the fight, I knew I'd won the fight, but I was to Herb Dean's right-hand side, and I knew he was going to pick up my left arm. I said, Herb, you can't pick up my left arm. I think I bust my collarbone. So I had to give him my right hand to race.
Yeah, I remember that. Well, I'm a physio by profession, so when I'm watching that sort of thing, I'm looking at you stood there, and I'm watching your shoulder, and I'm thinking, has he dislocated it? Because it looks like it's slightly forward, in that position.
It's really sore, to be honest. Really sore.
Yeah, it looked like, because you see, I mean, I think Manny Gambierian did the same when he was fighting Nick Diaz, didn't he? You know, he dislocated his shoulder on a takedown, and he lost that Ultimate Fighter.
Yeah,
I'm looking at you standing there with that left shoulder slightly forward. And I think, is it dislocated? When did that happen? Because you seemed to fight through the third, all right, didn't you?
Yeah. I mean, it was just kind of reactions, and I wasn't going to quit or anything like that. I was winning the fight 100%, so it's like no way was I quitting. Even if I lost that third round, which I didn't, even if I lost that third round, I would have still won by two rounds. So like, I was fine, you know. So I'm like, no. So. Yeah, but it took a long time to recover, to be fair. Like, the rehab on it was a long time. I think it was only a second degree. What is it? 3 degrees? It was like second degree tear. Yeah. But it was so painful for such a long time.
Yeah. Not well, fun. It was a tremendous performance. Yeah.
Thank you.
I guess the adrenaline took you through, probably, especially that last round. But just moving on from that. So over the years, obviously, the UFC, I guess, have been the dominant force in MMA. Now there are organizations like Bellator, N1 to rival them. Do you think it's a good thing to have multiple organizations that are pushing the UFC a little bit? Do you think that's a good thing for the sport, or do you think it's more beneficial to have one organization leading the way?
Well, yes and no. It's like, you have different ways of looking at it. As in, at the moment, UFC is still the front runner, but there are some amazing shows. And a lot of it's regional. So over here, you have Bellator and UFC, which is like in America, but then both of them are worldwide, but UFC is a lot more worldwide than Bellator. They then go to all the countries. But then you go over to Asia, you have like, you have 1FC, Risen, which are, I mean, great shows. We have fantastic fighters. And I do commentary for a show called ACA, which is in Russia, which are also Russia. They have N1 Global, ACA, Fight Nights. I mean, and I'm not even joking. When I'm there, I see some of the best fighters I've ever seen fighting and competing, which no one would have any clue of. Like Apti Bamavo, Yusuf Raisov. No, people are like, who are these people? But they're so, so good, you know. And but people just don't get to see them because they just watch UFC. But people in Russia know who they are, because in Russia, their UFC is ACA. So it kind of works that kind of way, if you ask me. You know? So, but it is good. It's not like boxing yet, where you have, in me, in my eyes, the best fighters in the world do fight each other in the UFC. But it's getting close now, where there are some, like I say, high level fighters who are not in the UFC. Well, that's what happened in boxing, where you have the WBA, WBC, WBO champions. You're thinking, but who's the best in the world? You two fight each other. No, politics won't let them two fight each other. No, it's just like, where it was for a long, long time pretty good, where if you want to see the best fighter in the world fight, you watch the UFC. Whoever holds that belt is the best fighter in the world at that weight class. And it just made it quite easier for the consumer to understand who's the best in the world.
Yeah, I agree with that. Ultimately, you want to see the best guys fighting the best guys. And I feel like, yeah, with boxing, it does get a bit too complicated. And sometimes the fights you do want to see end up happening 2-3 years down the line.
Or even like 10 or 15 years later, like exactly. Manny Pacquiao versus Mayweather. I love that fight back in the day.
And that was the issue. When that fight actually happened, you know, there was so much excitement. But the actual fight itself, I don't think anyone will, you know, pick it out as a great fight. So yeah, pros and cons to both, I guess. So I'll just hand over to John now, who will ask a few more.
Yeah, so we're just talking about the international aspect of MMA, and you raised some interesting points there. But go back through your career. I think I've been watching you something like 15 years now.
I'm that old.
What was it like coming through in the early days? So if you go back to, you know, your sort of early part of your career, where you're sort of one of the guys who's come through in the last sort of 15 years as a pioneer of the game in the UK, what was it like being a fighter at that time with a big success?
It's kind of strange. It's like, obviously, when I started and stuff, it wasn't a career path. It was just like a bit of fun and like next to no money, but it was fun to do, pretty cool, you know, cool kind of job, get to travel the world a little bit here and there. But now the sport's grown massively. It's actually a legitimate career path for a young and aspiring athlete. So like, where before, if you're a really good athlete as a kid, you go play in this country, you go play football, or you go do rugby, or you do some other sport. You would not go, or you box, we'll do MMA. Especially if you want to earn money from sport, that is. Where in America, you probably end up wrestling, or you do baseball, or you go do American football, or you do basketball if you're a really good athlete. But now, if you're a really good athlete and you like combat sort of sports, you could go into the UFC as a legitimate career path and earn life-changing money. Obviously, you're not everyone will. There's a smaller percentage that earn that sort of money, but it's definitely there. The path's been given to you by the likes of myself and Bisping and Dan Hardy and those sort of like Paul Daly, the UK sort of guys have gone on and then actually had proper careers out of this sport. And provided from the families, as in what I have now is what I provided for, like my house and all that sort of stuff, is what Fighting provided that for me.
Oh, yes. So when you look at that and you're coming in the early stages, who were your inspirations coming in?
Well, I didn't come in there. Well, early is in stages, yes, but I was 26 when I first started fighting. It wasn't really. I mean, back in those days, some fun fighters I liked. There's a Japanese fighter called Genki Sudo, very entertaining. I love the entertainment factor and excitement. You know, obviously back then there were things like Fedor and stuff like that. I used to love watching Pride.
So you
have all those sort of guys, you know. But also, I was a fan of the smaller weight classes, so I didn't really get to see people, you know. People obviously, Uriah Faber, Jens Pulver, Eve Edwards, you know, they're the people I love watching fight because they were smaller.
Yeah, that's good. So you mentioned earlier about like career paths in MMA. So what made you go with MMA rather than boxing? You know, I'm sure you could have had a great career in boxing.
I did box. I boxed between the age of 19 to 21 for a couple of years. I was 10-1 as an amateur. But I just kind of find boxing, especially amateur boxing, is a bit annoying for me. Isn't it? I was a bit of a puncher, right?
Yeah.
So I could go out there and I could whack you, knock you down with a left hook or whatever. You come up. You jab me, and we're equal because point's a point. You don't get scored for knockdowns in amateur boxing. So like, I was a bit annoyed from that boxing thing, and then actually ruptured my ACL because my main sport growing up was football, and I only done boxing just to keep fit. So when I ruptured my ACL playing Sunday morning football, I quit my football club I was playing for, and I actually stopped boxing for a little bit, you know, and stuff like that. And then when I tried to get back into boxing, it was a little bit later in it. I was about 25 or so. Just didn't get any attention because I was 25. So, like, no one cared about you, you know. So, I'm like, yeah, whatever. And so I said, why don't you try out mixed martial arts? And I remember going there. And it's so refreshing because once you know how to jab, cross, and stuff like that, it's like you just got to drill that. It's nice to learn a submission. Nice to learn a takedown. It's nice to learn just new things. So it was like a breath of fresh air to me, just something new.
Yeah, so how old were you when you had your ACL rupture?
I was 21.
Yeah, so
21 or 20.
Has that caused you any, I'm going all physio on you again, has that caused you any problems with MMA?
I've had no ACL, I didn't even reconstruct it, so I had no ACL my whole life, since I was 20.
That's doubly awesome then when you look at some of those takedown performances to consider that you've got no ACL in
the I've got no ACL on my right leg. I had no ACL for like say 20 years.
Yeah.
And competed like a high level in the sport. I used to play football at not a bad level, but when I went to my ACL, I got released from my club and all that sort of stuff. Because I'd done it playing Sunday morning football when I shouldn't have done. But I never got it reconstructed. They just went in and gave me a key scope and just took out the loose ligament. They took it out and then they just doing my bucket tear and all that, clean up my knee. And I just kind of learned how to do it, like how I kind of explained it to someone, especially with the sport I was doing. If you got 10 fingers and you learn how to play the piano and you lose a finger, then you're like, oh shit. Yeah. But if you've got 9 fingers and you learn how to play the piano, you learn how to play with 9 fingers, you know, just adapt. I kind of like learn how to look after my knee through fine. That's why I didn't really throw many kicks. It was my back leg and I kept it away from me. Yeah, so I don't know, I kind of got away with it. I had quite strong legs. And also, funny enough, probably, I mean, how long is it going now? Probably maybe 2 months ago, I ruptured my ACL in my left leg. So I've got no ACL in either of my legs.
I still
could train a little bit. I still grapple. I've been contemplating getting them fixed, but I'm like, I'm all right. I'm like, because I still have to be super careful with what I do. I'm very smart and selective to what I do. But yeah, I still train a little bit here and there. I cycle instead of run anymore, and stuff like that, because I don't know. Sometimes I think the rehab could be quite detrimental to me in the long run. You know, if you repair my ACL, but you take a bit of my hamstring out or something like that, and yeah, I think the rehab and that could just. I heard so many stories of people who have the ACLs mended and they feel worse. You know, so I'm just learning how to cope. Now I'm just a coach. I'm not really competing anymore. So, yeah, I don't need my ACLs, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I would say from a physio perspective, if you've managed for 20 years competitively without that, I wouldn't get it repaired now.
Yeah, but that's that one. But now I'm thinking now, because my left leg has always been supporting my right leg. So if I jumped up in the air and I landed, I'd land on my left leg. If I walked down some steps, I'd step down on my left leg. So they're things I do just like naturally now. I don't even think about it because I've done it for many, many years. But now my supporting leg is a little bit jeopardized. So it's like, and that now it's a little bit unstable here and there in certain ways. And it gives me a bit of shit. So, but I should really, it's a bit more rehab and get my legs stronger around the supporting muscles around my knee, and I should be all right.
I try some conservative rehab, because the thing is, it's a different leg, but you've been through it before, so you know it's you're capable of achieving it.
And
I think if you have the surgery, I mean, that's a later stage idea, but that rehab's going to be 12 months.
I don't fancy that either.
Yeah.
I say it'd be different if I'm walking every day and it's just going on me, and like, but it's not. I still grapple. Yeah, I don't wrestle as much now, unless I'm. But the thing is, I'm so smart. I know how to look after myself. I'm very defensive, and I still can give people a good little play here and there. And I just, you know, in certain areas. But yeah, I don't think I'm gonna ever be able to compete properly. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, if it troubles you in the future, give me a call. Right. So, going off that, you were saying about wrestling and so on. You've been involved with American Top Team for years. How did that start? Turned up in the US and start training with them. Did they take to you straight away?
There's a guy called Ricardo Laboya, who was the head coach of American Top Team, who founded the American Top Team with Dan Lambert. He came over to Cage Rage, and Cage Rage, which is Dave O'Donnell and Andy Gill, just chatting to him, invited him over for Shadham. And they said, hey, look, can we potentially send some of our champions over to the US? Because obviously Cage Rage was a little bit smarter, where they knew for their champions, like their British champions, to compete on the world stage, they need to get better at wrestling. So they thought, oh, can we send some of our guys out? And I was forever grateful for what Cage Rage did for me, where I think it paid a load of money when I fought. But what happened is, the guy who owned Cage Rage was a guy called Andy Gear, and he has a building firm. So he'd employ me to work at his building firm. So I was a roofer by trade and doing stuff like that. So I work, but then I'll go out to American Top Team and I'll still get paid my weekly wage, you know, and I'll be training full time. So I was getting paid for full time training, which was just absolutely amazing.
Unheard of back in the day, wasn't it?
Absolutely unheard of. And then when I fought, I didn't get paid much money, but I'm like, whoa, I don't care. You've just literally funded my whole training camp and all that sort of stuff. So you've already paid me. So it was amazing. So I always say to this day, if it wasn't for them guys who did that, I wouldn't be the fighter I was today. And it was their growth. So when I first went out to American Top Team, I met Mike Brown.
Yeah.
And we'd hit it off straight away. And, you know, we're best mates for many, many years. And we're still best mates now. And and stuff like that. Yeah, he was like the best man at my wedding. And, you know, we were really mates, and it was always fun. And I learned so much of him because he is a phenomenal fighter. Yeah, but then also now he's a phenomenal, absolute phenomenal. I would say I think he's the best MMA coach in the world by far.
Yeah, he's a great coach, isn't he? He's you can see that in what he produces.
He just has a great understanding, not just for techniques, just for people and how to get the best out of them, and so on and so forth. So he's awesome.
And over your career, you fought a lot of tough fights, and you never looked like you've been anyone to back down from anyone. What did you make of the notion these days that get bandied around that some fighters will protect their records, you know, by picking and choosing? And you seem to have pretty much fought everyone who turned up. A lot of guys years ago did, you know, guys like Ross Poynter and stuff used to as well, and it reflects in their records sometimes. But what do you make of the guys who perhaps pick and choose a little bit more?
I get that side of the game because it's turning in a little bit more boxing thing, because when you have an unbeaten record or so on and so forth, it's always more intriguing to the casual. Where a hardcore fan will see who you've been beating and who you've been fighting, where a casual guy will go, oh, he's 10-0, amazing, oh, how good is this guy, kind of thing. So, yeah, so, it's just a part of the sport, you know. But like I say, if you're a hardcore fan, but I was a fighter, so I just wanted to fight the best people and test myself, and always, you know, I always believed in myself. I always said it throughout my whole career, no matter who I fought. If it was the best guy in the world, I'd be in a very good competitive fight. If it was one of the worst guys, I'd be in a very good competitive fight. If it was the postman, I'd be in a good... Whatever it was, I just didn't get myself in a good fight. That's the one thing I always did.
Yeah. I mean, on the back of that as well, you know, you came up that kind of old school way, like you say, like fighting everyone and just putting your best performance out there. And you did all that off minimal kind of like media. So what do you make these days of like the whole kind of social media boom with fighters, that guys are on social media all the time promoting stuff, commenting on things? How do you think that's kind of changed for fighters these days?
It's just a massive change of the sport. I was around a little bit, if that makes sense. Mm. But my first sort of platform was a thing called MySpace, and then after MySpace went to, I think it was Facebook, then Facebook went to Twitter, then Twitter went to Instagram, then Instagram went to Snapchat, now it's TikTok. It's like, I mean, it's just fucking mad, too much, you know, like, but I get it, because brands want exposure, and fans, I mean, fighters can give them that exposure if they have a good fan base, and so on and so forth. And some people make a living off their fan base more than do fighting. You know, someone like Paige Van Zandt, because of sort of like social media, how good she was on it. She got a lot of fans, and then she was on Dancing with the Stars in America. And she's not a bad fighter, but she's nowhere near the level of fighter her pull. And then also, when you have that sort of following, it becomes a bargaining chip. You know, you could demand more money and so on and so forth. So it's definitely a part of the sport that is very new, but all the young people get it and love it. But I do social media, but I find it's something that would be a bit cringy if you do too much.
Yeah. So, I mean, when you look at your record as well, we talked about, you know, not backing away from anyone. You had a lot of fights early on, and I think in 1 year you had six fights. You had a lot of quick turnarounds with only weeks apart. Was that part of a game plan, or were you just enjoying the rock?
No, kind of. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't any younger, was I? I wasn't like, so I was just like trying to build a CV as such, you know, like. You better your CV is, the more places you could go. And I just kind of like fighting. And I was one of those people who was kind of like, I wanted a fight to train, you know, like to train for. And I always needed a kind of like a goal, something to push me to get up early, to train, go running in the morning, then go to work, then go train in the evening. And, you know, like, I needed something to push me. I was, you know, really push myself as much.
Yeah. So if we take your nickname, I mean, it's a pretty standout nickname, isn't it? One Punch. You know, and I think I remember you mentioning it in a couple of fights at the end when you've had a few decisions, and then you get like a finished knockout, and you're referencing it.
Yeah.
I mean, you've had like knockout of the nights, you've had submission of the nights, and you've got a pretty serious ground game as well. You know, when again that Demetrius fight sort of shows it. But which accolade means more to you, to get a knockout of the night or to get a submission of the night? Which one's get more important?
100% a knockout, because it just feels way, it's like, it feels way more primal and manly to knock someone out than it would do to submit someone. Mm. You know? So, but to be honest, I used to like beating someone by, well, one of my favorite sort of things I'd say is making someone quit. So I used to, like I say, I've got quite a few submissions on my record, but I say a lot of those submissions is someone just like, get me the fuck out of here. I don't want to be here, you know, like, I want to get out. So they give you an arm, they give you the neck, and you feel that within a fight when you mentally break someone, and you know, like, okay, they've stopped now. That's it. They're giving up. They're gonna look for a way out, and I kind of love that sometimes, you know, or even just beating someone up for three rounds and dominating them. Making someone quit was one of the most empowering, manly sort of things.
I think I've heard that from a number of fighters. I think Ken Shamrock says it in his biography, that it's one thing knocking someone out, but you haven't got a choice when you get knocked out. You just knocked out. So, but when you make somebody submit, it's a conscious decision on their part to give in to you. And so it's almost like, you know, you've taken their soul in a sense, you know, taking their will.
Yeah, I mean, I like knockouts, but it's not even about like submission. You can even get like I've had TKO knockouts where someone's just tapping because I'm battering them, and they're like, okay, I've had enough. And that's another mental quit, you know. So like, just making someone quit was very empowering for me.
Yeah. That's a nice side of you coming out there, Brad. Yeah. Yeah. That's the caring father side of you.
Exactly.
Yeah. So talking of knocking people out and beating them up. So you moved on to some bare knuckle boxing, haven't you? Become a British flyweight champion last year.
Yeah. So, was last year or the year before? One of the two.
2019 was it? Or
I have no clue.
It's all, to be honest, this year has become all a bit of a blur now, hasn't it?
Yeah. It's just 2020 is just fucking weird.
Yeah. What was the attraction there, and where are you going with that? Are you going to do some more, or did you just want to get the title? Or
I'll tell you the story behind it. Isn't like not letting people know. I should do an autobiography or something like that, because it's quite interesting. Yeah. But when I first got into fighting, boxing, that was first. My mum said to me, "Oh, you get that from your granddad." I didn't know my granddad because he died when I was four. But when I looked at pictures of him, he used to work at as a roofer during the day, but he used to do bare knuckle boxing at night time just to earn a bit of extra money for the family. Yeah. So when I looked at pictures, he used to wear a Trilby hat and braces.
Okay.
So I'm like, cool, I'm going to wear a Trilby hat and braces to my fight and pay tribute to my granddad who used to bare knuckle boxer. So that's why everyone thought I was trying to be like a snatch or something like that, but it was nothing to do with that, right? My boxing name One Punch came from my name One Punch came from boxing, but my image was because I'm from the East End of London. I'm a Cockney, my granddad used to be a bare knuckle boxer, so he was paying tribute to him. That's why I came out to Chaz and Dave. They're family friends of mine, you know. So so that is all kind of like just make things are meant something to me, and so that's when. So, bare knuckle boxing. So, when I retired from fighting, I retired. I'm like, cool, I'm done. I was at the highest end of my sport, and I've achieved what I could do, trying to be number one in the world, did achieve it. So, okay, cool, I'm happy, I'm leave. Cool, I'm done.
Yeah.
But then someone says, maybe do you want to have a bare knuckle boxing match? So, I mean, you know what? I think it'd be a story. glory of my fighting career to have a bare knuckle boxing match. I didn't want to go on to go prove I'm the next best thing in bare knuckle boxing. But I do think that my fighting style really plays well to bare knuckle boxing. My sort of boxing style in MMA, and I think also having against pro glove boxers, they're so used to having big gloves. Well, I become very used to having small gloves,
yeah.
So that it's quite similar to having no gloves and being bare knuckle. And then also business wise, when I looked at it, I was like, I just retired from the UFC, which is the best organization in the world, fighting the best level fighters in the world. Anyone really is going to give me trouble in bare knuckle boxing? Are not bare knuckle boxing. They're fighting glove boxing, or yeah. They're in the UFC or something like that. So I'm like, well, there's not really people my level fighting in bare knuckle boxing. So yeah, cool. I'm going to have a bare knuckle boxing match and I'll fight for the title. So that's what I did. Done that. Won. And that was it. I'm no real. Every now and again, I'm like, yeah, I wouldn't mind it. Yeah, but I'm not realistic. I've got no ACLs.
Yeah.
Two kids I want to talk to for the rest of my life. I wouldn't be doing it for money. I'm okay for money. So, I mean, I'm not desperate where I need to, you know, go fighting because I need to pay bills or anything stupid like that. But I did. For me, fighting is a very dangerous sport. And you have to be very motivated to go and fight. I was motivated for my first bare knuckle boxing fight because it was new to me. I wanted to go do that. So I was motivated to train. Now I wouldn't be as motivated to train unless I wanted to fight someone who I really wanted to fight, which is no one out there I really want to fight, really. So it's not really, and I'm not motivated by money. So someone goes, I'll give you £1 million. For 1 minute, I'll be like, yeah, awesome. And then I like, after a while, I'll be like, I'm not motivated by money. I was always motivated by competition and challenges. So that's why I find that I had to be motivated. So I wouldn't be motivated to fight again, really, unless I found some motivation from somewhere or for some reason to do it or someone I wanted to fight to do it. So yeah, I'm happy with what I've done, and now it's just my job to pass it on to the next, pass my knowledge on to the next generation.
Yeah, well, I think, to be honest, that makes a really, really great story, and just brings it right round to the beginning, doesn't it, with like your granddad and your whole image.
Exactly.
Starting fighting. I think it's a beautiful story, that is. And do you know what, there's a biopic in that somewhere, isn't there?
Yeah.
Channel 4 make a film of that. That'd be great, wouldn't it? You can have a bit part in the background, can't you?
Cast Brad Pitt for it, you know.
Yeah. If he's lucky. Yeah.
That
makes a nice ending, a nice tribute to your granddad as well, that does, doesn't it? You know.
Yes, indeed.
And you can walk away from that as British champion. So you came, you saw, you conquered with that, and ended your career on a high there, can't you, as well?
Indeed, exactly. That's what I mean. There's no fairy tale endings in certain things, as you saw in my last fight in the UFC. I was winning that fight for 2 rounds, and literally 4 minutes on the last round, and then I just got caught and lost. So you can see there's no fairy tale ending. Yeah. So it's nice that if I could finish it up, at least I finished it on a win in bare knuckle boxing.
And a nice poetic win for the family as well, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, indeed.
That's brilliant, mate. So I'll hand you back over to Costa.
Great stuff, Brad. I was just enjoying listening to all of that. Just a couple more questions before we let you go.
Sure.
So, yeah, as we've talked about, MMA right now is probably bigger than it's ever been. So looking back from your perspective, as one of the fighters who built a foundation of MMA in the UK particularly, how does that make you feel now, looking at the sport, receiving the recognition it does, and knowing that you've played a massive part to that?
That makes me feel old. But no.
Makes us all feel old, mate.
No, I feel good, you know, like, I feel... Yeah, I mean, I'm happy with what I did, you know, and stuff like that. And I mean, like, I feel honoured. It's nice to get a bit of love still here and there. But it's like, without getting a violin out, in 5 years' time, people are going to have no clue who I am. I that's just how it is, you know. So that's my job now, is to create new people, you know, and, you know, keep my competitive streak going through my fighters and so on and so forth. So that's my next sort of role. I've had my limelight sort of thing. Now it's time for my fighters to have their own limelight and create their own legacies and do their own things. So yeah, that's just my, it's just how the path of life goes. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, that leads to the next question, actually, which you touched on, which is in terms of what the future holds. Are you 100% committed now to the coaching side of things and sort of bringing these guys through? Is that where all your focus is?
Yeah, I think like I'm a full-time coach. I have my own team, GB Top Team. I'm still in the hunt for my own premises, really. I'm renting in someone else's gym, which is too small. But I'm in the process of... we'll get my own premises, which I want, but COVID is just like kicking everyone in the balls at the moment, so it's a bit tricky. And then I do a lot of commentary for ACA, which is a Russian organization, so I love my job there as well, because I get to watch fights and call fights, so that's awesome, you know. So definitely the rest of my life I'll be within the sport.
Great to hear. Well, obviously, from our side, thanks for all the contributions over the years, and best of luck with the coaching and the commentary.
No problem at all. Much appreciated. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for talking, Brad. And any more problems with that knee, give me a shout, mate.
No worries. Thank you. Much appreciated. Cheers, guys. Thanks, everyone.
Take care. Cheers.
See you later.